The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network. Greetings, scribes. I have got some exciting news to share. The Writer Files now has an exclusive Patreon community where subscribers will get exclusive access to uncut ad-free interviews, a writer's happy hour, bonus breakdowns, and content from productivity and publishing experts each month. In the meantime, just head over to patreon.com/thewriterfiles. It's free to join Patreon to get a preview, and you can upgrade anytime. That's patreon.com/thewriterfiles. Help us start something special.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This week's episode is sponsored by Neuro. Neuro makes functional gum and mints that help you better your mind and do more. Launched by athletes with backgrounds in neuroscience and chemistry, they imagined health supplements you could easily carry around in your pocket and take on the go throughout the day instead of having to gulp down a bunch of pills in the morning. The great thing is these patented cold compressed gum and mints are gluten-free, sugar-free, vegan, and work a lot faster than drinks and supplements. They're loved by Olympians, engineers, academics, fitness heads, and creatives like you and me, stuck at home staring at the screen. The energy and focus products have been shown to improve brain performance in a pilot study out of the Harvard Innovation Lab. And the new Calm and Clarity line uses ingredients scientifically shown to reduce stress and stabilize mood. Because they're gum and mints, they're easy to carry, taste great, and give you fresh breath. I honestly love them because they take the stress out of having to brew or find that cup of coffee or tea during the lull in the day that we could all use a boost. Head over to getneuro.com to order and better your state of mind now. That's GetNeuro.com. GetNeuro.com. Use the code WRITER to get 15% off your first order today.
I suppose writing, like any art form, or any activity really done well, is when you actually discover something about yourself and you feel slightly bigger than you were because you didn't know that thing was there. So it's kind of like a journey into part of a dream world of imagination. And that's the stuff I really like.
Greetings, scribes, and welcome back to The Writer Files. I am still your grateful host, Kelton Reed, sending you positivity, productivity, and prosperity per usual. And I'm cooking up some extras for fans of the show in the coming weeks you won't want to miss, including the option to have episodes, extras, and added insights delivered straight to your inbox, and maybe even some Writer Files merch on the way. Hit me up on Twitter with suggestions at Kelton Reed, and that link is on writerfiles.fm. This week, internationally best-selling author Matt Haig spoke with me about how the novelist became an accidental mental health expert, why writers need resilience, and the success of The Midnight Library. Matt's the author of 20 books, including the number one best-selling memoir, Reasons to Stay Alive, 5 novels, including How to Stop Time, and several award-winning children's books. His work's been translated into over 40 languages. His latest is Midnight Library, a runaway number one bestseller and reader favorite of 2020. It was a Goodreads Choice Awards Best Fiction Book of 2020, a Best Book of the Year by the Washington Post, Amazon, the New York Public Library, and many others. The New York Times said of the book, "An absorbing vision of limitless possibility, new roads taken, new lives lived, of a whole different world available to us somehow, somewhere, perhaps exactly what's wanted in these troubled and troubling times." In this file, Matt and I discussed his superhero origins and the blog post that became a book, how to write like no one's watching, inconsistent routines and the power of deadlines, why writers need to surprise themselves, how he got Oscar-nominated actress Carey Mulligan to record his audiobook, and more. Stay calm and write on. And stay tuned for a clip from the Midnight Library audiobook after the interview, excerpted courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio, read by the very talented Carrie Mulligan. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click subscribe to automatically see new interviews as soon as they're published. And leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts to help other writers find us. Yes, we are back on The Writer Files, and I am honored today to be joined by a very special guest. I have bestselling author Matt Haig. How are you surviving, sir?
I'm okay, actually. I'm okay. Well, I'm in the south coast of England at the moment, and the sun is streaming through the window, which is very rare for February. And we haven't got any of your crazy American weather at the moment. And yeah, no, it's okay. It's one of those days where you don't really know why you're having a good day, other than to talk to you, Kelton, obviously. But it's just, you know, the universe is in temporary alignment, and all things are good, despite obviously still being in the midst of pandemics and lockdowns here. We're still in lockdown, but yeah, I'm feeling quite good in myself.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I know you're a busy man, and I can't wait to talk all things writing, and of course, the paperback of The Midnight Library just came out, so we're lucky to get some time to spend with you. And yeah, I want to pick your brain. So let's do the kind of the Cliff's Notes of your winding path to internationally bestselling author. And, you know, I mean, I've spent some time with your nonfiction books, Reasons to Stay Alive, and others. And it's interesting, you know, with The Midnight Library being this fictional tale told from a completely different point of view. But yeah, kind of wind back a clock a little bit for us and give us your superhero origin story, because, you know, going back to Reasons to Stay Alive in that memoir, you know, you kind of talk about this time when you weren't a writer.
Absolutely. And it's been a long trek. I mean, just to give you some context, The Midnight Library is, it makes me feel so old. But it's book number 20. Now, a lot of those books, well, then it's not just adult books for a start. I've also written children's books, and I've written nonfiction, as you say. And a lot of those books early on weren't particularly, you know, they weren't read or widely known. But yes, technically it is 20 books, including fiction and nonfiction. So it has been a long, winding path, and this superhero origin story, there is no sort of single moment, there's no radioactive spider moment biting me. I suppose if there is one, I mean, that book you mentioned, Reasons to Stay Alive, that in the UK, in my country, that was kind of a turning point for me, which was quite interesting, because up until that point I'd been writing fiction, so this was the first time I'd put me in a book. And I was very apprehensive about it. I had only written that book. That was the first time I'd written a book because I was asked to write a book. And it wasn't by my publisher. It was by a friend who happened to work in publishing, but she wasn't my publisher. She just thought, you know, it'd be a good thing. I because I'd written a blog, basically, and that blog had been called Reasons to Stay Alive. And it was just a one-off blog, and it had quite a good reaction. And she was one of the people who read it. And she said, "Oh, have you thought about turning this into a book?" And I hadn't, partly because I wouldn't know how to do it, because and I didn't, you know, I wasn't a celebrity, so I thought, you know, where's the interest in this? You know, my experience of mental health issues, you know, it's not particularly unique or that extreme. Yes, I was suicidal for a while, and she said, "Yeah, but that's kind of the point. You know, it'll be more relatable, because it's within the ballpark of quite a lot of people's experience who've had mental health difficulties." And so she slowly talked me into it. And I wrote that book like almost as if no one was watching, as if no one would read it. And partly because I thought no one would really read it, because my publishers, when I'd mentioned it to them, and I had a reasonable success before with a book called The Humans. It wasn't a bestseller or anything, but it had gone down well with the people who'd read it and stuff. And I felt in a relatively safe position with the publisher. But even so, they were not enamored of the idea of me switching to nonfiction, of me suddenly talking about myself and talking about mental health. And they said, why don't you just turn it into a novel and do this? But I held my guns and, you know, got paid significantly less to write it. But I still thought, you know, this is going to find a certain readership and it might be of use to people. And then it just sort of, that was the book that took off. You know, I got a bit lucky with a few sort of radio hits in the UK and stuff. But generally, that was kind of an organic word of mouth thing, and it happened slowly. It was a slow burn, mm-hmm. and it just sort of grew and grew and grew. So it was the opposite trajectory to the normal path where you get published, you have a little bit of a marketing blitz or whatever, and then it's a sort of decline. This the graph, the line was sort of going upwards with it, which was a very unusual feeling. And it was a very nice feeling after being a struggling writer at the coalface for a long time. But the only problem was that because it was this book and not that book and not a novel, it threw me for two reasons. One, because I saw myself as a novelist and I wanted my novels to be big and being read and out there. And also because, yeah, I suddenly felt very exposed. I suddenly became, after having always identified myself as sort of an author, as a novelist, I was suddenly like put forward as mental health expert, and people were emailing me with their problems. So I was like, it was a very bittersweet moment, and the kind of be careful what you wish for moment, where, you know, I almost had a mental health dip around the time of that being published, because I was like, well, I should be happy because we've got this successful book, da 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 da, and this is what I've wanted. But because it was that particular book, I felt very exposed, and it took me. I'm still very glad I wrote that book, for all kinds of reasons. I don't think it's my best book by any means, but I'm glad I put it out there. But yeah, it was a very interesting transition. You know, and my, aside from the mental health stuff, I've had a very sort of up and down career, certainly in the early phases. You know, well, I had the normal story of being rejected loads and loads of times. I think it probably, if you totted it up, it'd be over 50, 60 times for my first novel being rejected. Then I got my foot through the door with an agent. Then it was another year before going in at lowest level with a sort of traditional publishing market. And I wrote three books for my first publisher. Then I was dropped. Then I was sort of back to square one again. And then I took the bull in my own hands, I got quite resilient and just sort of kept on going, and held on long enough. And yeah, it slowly, I found the right publisher for me in the UK. It was very small, independent. Well, they're a big independent, but they're small compared to sort of the big publishers, called Canongate, and they've been brilliant for me. And I've had almost, in the last 10 years I've been with them, I've had almost a old-fashioned type of career where you start small and you grow, which is quite kind of rare these days, because the paths seem to be, you either start small and you sort of stay at a level, or you start middle, you stay at a level, or you have this big, we see it all the time, you know, people get 6 or 7 figure deals and they get this big hyped debut thriller or whatever. And then there's a lot of pressure for them to do this second, you know, they have this amazing hit and this amazing time, and then some of the momentum goes away with second or third book. So I've been quite lucky that I've been able to build under the radar a readership, you know what I mean? And, you know, at times it's been frustrating and I've been impatient and stuff like that. But I feel like playing the long game, it's benefited me.
Yeah. So resilience, adversity, and kind of playing the long game. And now 3 million books later. And just a quick aside to revisit the exclusive Writer Files Patreon community, where subscribers get access to uncut ad-free interviews, a writer's happy hour, bonus breakdowns, and a lot more. I know that for serious writers, it can be more distracting than ever to cut through the noise, stay productive, and home in on what's happening in the publishing industry. Over 8 years, we've provided a looking glass into the habits of professional writers and publishing industry insiders. And as your humble host, I've decided to launch a membership-based Patreon for serious scribes to cut through the noise, swap tips and tricks, and hang out with like-minded peers. Just head over to patreon.com/thewriterfiles for bonus writing resources, monthly episode breakdowns, writer's happy hour, a community of your peers, ad-free episodes, and more. It's free to join to get a preview, and you can upgrade anytime. That's patreon.com/thewriterfiles.
Help us start something cool and special. Keep calm and write on.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
That's amazing. I mean, so the Midnight Library has been number one in the UK. It was an instant New York Times bestseller, of course. Good Morning America book club pick. No slouch there. And congratulations on the success of that. And it's a fascinating book. I think I want to talk about some of the themes in the book, of course. You cover some of these existential dilemmas that we all face, of course, but... let's talk about The Midnight Library. And of course, it's a book about a library between life and death, which I love the idea of. I think a lot of people resonate with that, but a look at regret, second chances, and kind of what makes life worth living. And, these are themes that you've, of course, talked about at length, but kind of talk about the genesis of this.
Yeah.
And
It's a long genesis. And I think actually, even though I've written a lot of books, when I think of the books that have sort of like struck a chord or done better than my others, it's often books that have been gestating for quite a while. Like I'd wanted to write a parallel life story, almost as long as I've been a writer. It's just I never really had the hook or a reason, because it's an overcrowded genre, really. It's certainly in film, but also in books, you can think of a lot of parallel life stories or alternative life stories. And although it's always an idea that fascinated me, I thought I don't have enough new to add to the mix here. And it wasn't really until I got the concept of the library where I thought, okay, this could be worth doing because I like libraries. As a teenager, my sort of safe space was going to the library after school and not necessarily to read, but to just sort of like hang out and do my homework or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I feel like libraries are the sort of, but sort of like portals anyway, I think it felt like a perfect metaphor for a parallel universe, because I suppose if you're in a space that's surrounded by books, then books are kind of our entry point to other worlds, as close as we'll ever get to sort of living other lives. And, a library is full of that. So I like that conceit. I think Stephen King in On Writing, he always talks about how there are two types of books. There are the books that kind of write themselves, where everything flows and it's easy running and it kind of happens on its own momentum. Or there's the other kind of book where you're kind of pushing a boulder up a hill and it's hard work and you don't know if you'll get there. And the Midnight Library was kind of one of those ones. It was kind of hard because there were a lot of changes and it was great, it's great having a high concept idea because you think, well, that's a great hook and it's a great high concept idea. But but then you building story and character around it, that's the tricky part. Often it's easier to start with a character and go that way. But with the Midnight Library, I started with the concept and went from there, which was great in some ways because it made the book feel very sort of consistent with itself. And I knew from the outset what the theme was and all of that.
Yeah.
But it had so many changes. Like the first draft, for instance, the central character in the book now is a 35-year-old female, Nora Seed, and someone very overtly different to me. But the first draft, it was a male main character, 40s, very similar to my position in life, very similar mental health history to me. And it just wasn't working. You just get a sense, I think, don't you, when something's not working. And one warning sign for me in my own writing, if I'm changing the name of a character a lot, I think I have not got this character. So he went, he was Adam, he was Leo, it was all these different names. And I thought, no, the problem isn't the name. The problem is the character. And I think it was almost too close to myself, like if you're staring at your face in the mirror too long and you never really know what you look like. It was kind of like, but that was the mirror. I was sort of like writing very realistic stuff that had applied to me, but it just, as a character, it didn't work. And I changed it to Nora, and I deliberately, I mean, I suppose it's kind of like a spare book in some ways, and that was, I don't do lengthy character descriptions. I mean, that's not my thing anyway. I'm quite a brief kind of writer. I'm into short chapters and, you know, I'll give a hint at someone's hair color or something, but I won't give you lengthy detail of what someone looks like or, you know, their life story.
Yeah.
But somehow, as soon as I had the name Nora, as soon as I had, you know, her job and where she was living and her mental health, I kind of saw her in my head as a real person in a way that I hadn't before. So that's what gave the novel life to me, and that's what made me end up finishing the novel, is that I actually had someone I related to, but not too much. It wasn't like this person was me. And that, mm-hmm. that was the turning point with this book.
Yeah, the library idea, obviously, the kind of the portal to other worlds. And I don't know. I mean, some of my favorite Instagram accounts are kind of like what's known as like library porn. They're just like, they're just like famous libraries around the world that are kind of otherworldly or kind of, you know, transport you. But
I've seen some of those. Yeah.
I love that idea. But yeah, you talked about kind of writing as self-therapy, and we've talked about this recently with other authors. Obviously, a lot of people are kind of going through a similar situation, just with, you know, kind of the malaise or the kind of this, what we call like the Groundhog's Day effect of the pandemic and how writing is, you know, kind of transportative in its own right.
Yeah.
But yeah, I want to talk kind of about, you know, where you go from here, what's next. I want to talk more, maybe more about your process and kind of like what the most prolific day for you kind of looks like as a writer.
Yeah, I need more of a routine, but I don't really have a routine that's consistent. I'm very sort of like, I swing between a lot of times of days and weeks and months of writing, not very much at all. You know, I'll still be thinking about novels. I'll still be writing the odd sentence here. I'll be researching. I'm in that phase at the moment, actually, when I'm not sort of doing promo stuff for Midnight Library. I'm just trying to get into the next novel idea. And that I'm in that zone for quite a lot. So even though people think of me as quite prolific and I write a lot of stuff, I feel like I have long patches of months where I'm not actually writing that much. But then that's counterbalanced by shorter periods where I'm writing a lot and where I don't have weekends. And if I set some sort of deadline, even if it's a very flexible penciled in deadline, I'll always want to keep the deadline, and I'll just like having something to work to. And even if it's a self-set deadline, I think deadlines, especially with novels, because they're such, you know, they're such big beasts. Even my relatively small novels are kind of, you know, but longer than writing an essay. You know, I can remember being at college, at university, as we call it, and how much of an achievement it seemed to be to write like 2,500 words of an essay. And, you know, now, but, you know, you can do that in a day now. I mean, I suppose a very good writing day for me would be writing about 5,000 words or something if I'm really in full flow. Now, a lot of those words won't make the final draft.
Sure.
But there's a sort of phase. I think with me, it's different, obviously, every writer. But with me, the best bit is first draft, but not the very start of the first draft where you don't know what's going on. But the point where you've sort of passed the halfway mark in the story, you're kind of confident with the characters. You kind of know where you're going to end up. And you're in that three quarters of the way through, and often you can take a little tangent. Or when you surprise yourself, when things aren't too planned out, where you know enough to be confident, I feel like certainly with fiction writing, the best bits for me, it's almost like, you know, fishing, and you're on the bank of the river, and something unexpected, you know, you catch a bigger fish than you realized or whatever. And yeah, you weren't expecting. So I suppose writing, like any art form or any activity really done well, is when you actually discover something about yourself and you feel slightly bigger than you were because you didn't know that thing was there. So it's kind of like a journey into part of that dream world of imagination. And that's the stuff I really like, where you think, that's a good idea, or you know. And it sounds very self-indulgent because you're like, oh yes, clever me. But it is fun, you know, being a human, having an imagination and just sort of going somewhere. And yeah, so I'm one of those writers who actually likes first draft. I'm the sort of person who gets bored very easily. So the editing process for me is when it really feels like work and a bit of a chore, and when you're redrafting, and certainly when the sort of official editor from a publisher gets involved, and then you have the back and forth about which bits, you know. And I find that kind of stressful. And I never know the balance between how much to trust my own judgment versus how much to trust the editor's judgment. Even though I've worked with this editor now for over 10 years, there's still aspects where I think, well, he could be right or I could be right, and I don't really know. But you know, that's part of the process, I suppose. So I'm generally a first draft person, I think.
Interesting. Kind of riding the line there between chaos, entropy, and
yes, exactly.
A pantser. Yeah. So to speak. But yeah, no, the preparation and incubation phase makes a lot of sense. It sounds like you kind of lean into some of the procrastination piece, but you're hitting these longer sprints when you have a head of steam there. But yeah, so you're no stranger to kind of adaptations of your work. And of course, for Midnight Library, I got a chance to listen to some of the audiobook, which is voiced by someone rather famous, Carey Mulligan.
Yeah,
is that right?
That's ridiculous. I know, but yes, and I think, you know, well, she recorded it in when Britain was having its first lockdown last year, and because she's her partner's a musician, they've got like a home recording studio their house, and I think like. Much of the world, the film industry had completely closed down. And so she might have had a few scripts to read or whatever, but like everyone else, she was a lot of people, she was sort of twiddling her thumbs. And I think it came along at the right moment. And yeah, serendipity and no, very surreal. I'm also lucky that the people who published me in the UK, there's a guy who runs it, Jamie Bing, who is a character, to say the least. And he's the kind of person who knows a lot of people, and he's quite shameless. You know, he'll shoot for the stars. You know, he'll say, oh yeah, no problem, Benedict Cumberbatch, Carey Mulligan, we'll get them, we'll get the agent on the phone. And you know, it's been quite inspiring for me, actually, because so often when you don't like get things in life, it's often not that you've actually been stopped by some outside force. It's just that you thought, no, I can't go up to that person, or I can't ask that person. Yeah. And he hasn't got any of that. So he's sort of like this fearless person, and he knows a lot of people. And I'm the opposite of that. I never have the guts to sort of go up to new people or even email new people sometimes. So it's great to have him on your side, who will say, oh yeah, I think Carey Mulligan would be perfect, and we worked with her once before 2 years ago, and this, that, and the other, and then makes it happen. So that's great, especially as audiobooks seem to be, you know, they seem to be so important nowadays. Yeah. It seems to me more and more people are consuming books that way, whether it's the podcast era helping that or whatever. People are getting used to listening to content, aren't they? So
absolutely,
yeah. If you've got someone who can do a good job of the audio adaptation, that really matters now.
Yeah, amazing. Well, A Boy Called Christmas is being turned into a film that's going to be coming out holiday season 2021, which is pretty exciting. All-star cast there. Any interest in the Midnight Library for adaptations yet? Or?
Yeah, I mean, the same company who are doing the children's book, A Boy Called Christmas, they've optioned it. And obviously that doesn't mean it will necessarily be a film. It just means they've got the rights to make the film.
Right.
But I think, because things are going quite well with the children's film, that they're definitely wanting to make it, and they're very serious about it. I mean, they're not the type of company who buy up everything and the off chance they'll make some of it. I think that they pretty much only take on things that they want to make. But that said, it's the film world, and the film world's uncertain at the best of times. And, you know, we're obviously in a very sort of uncertain era in terms of film. Yeah. So we'll see, but, I've learned that it's often best to go with people you know, or you have contact with. And, you know, they've done such a good job with my children's book, A Boy Called Christmas, that I just thought, yeah, let's just go with them and see what happens. So it's a watch this space situation. But yeah, A Boy Called Christmas, that will be out on Netflix Christmas time.
Well, before we wrap up here with your advice to your fellow scribes on just how to persevere during hard times, I will just mention The Midnight Library, out in paperback now. A feel-good book guaranteed to lift your spirits, said the Washington Post, of course. The blurbs fill up like two pages here, so I mean, I could go on and on. I could probably spend an entire show just reading the reviews and the blurbs, but pretty amazing praise for the book. Congrats on that. And what's next for you? Are you fiction, nonfiction, or just kind of percolating?
Well, I have... what I wrote last year was a very short nonfiction book called The Comfort Book, which is very much does what it says on the tin. You know, it's anything that comforts me. So there's lots of quotations in there. There's lots of stuff about films or books that comfort me. There's some ancient Greek philosophy in there. It's totally nonlinear. It felt so freeing to write something that isn't structured in any conventional way. It's one of those books that you can kind of dip in at page 65 cool. or 120. And, you know, that's probably not going to be the same sort of, have the same sort of big push as something like Midnight Library, but it was really fun to write. And that's coming out later this year, both in my side of the Atlantic and yours. And other than that, yeah, fiction, basically. I'm trying to come up with a new novel idea for adults. And I've had for the first time in my life something that resembles writer's block, but I don't really get writer's block. It's more like writer's total indecision. So that I have things to write, but I just, you know, it's like I never know. I don't have a gauge in my head at the very early stage of, yeah. How good they are. You know, it's just like I have to, it's a really annoying thing because it would be so nice to instantly dismiss it rather than dismiss it after you've written 10,000 words or whatever. And you think, that's not like it. So writer's I'm in indecision. That phase. I think I've turned the corner, but it's still early days. So we will see.
I love it. Well, I'm going to point at matthaig.com. And of course, you're on Twitter, Instagram, and all the places. I'll put all the links in the show notes. One pearl of wisdom for your fellow scribes on just how to keep going.
I think this might be a cliche and a bit corny, but I genuinely think the only reader you're ever going to know is yourself. Like I can remember like getting advice early on from book industry people and from agents and in rejection letters and stuff. And I always talked about the market and researching the market and knowing this or, you know, knowing about, you know, your favorite genre and all of that stuff, you know, it's got value to it as well. But, you know, we're not mind readers. The only person, the only reader you're ever going to know, truly know, honestly know, is yourself. You're only going to know your own taste. So you have to sort of develop, I think, a trust in yourself. That doesn't mean you have to be sort of like arrogant about it or not listen to advice from editors or agents and stuff like that, because you have to take on board all of that stuff. But what it's more about, not trying to second guess, not trying to write something because you think it's right for someone else. You have to write literally the book you would want to read in that moment. I think that's the only way to be entirely true. And it doesn't mean everyone's going to like it. You know, not everyone likes The Midnight Library. You know, you only need to, if you truly like it, you will find other people who it speaks to as well. And I think that's ultimately it. Because that's the bit I struggled with for a while. Because I'm like, I'm a people pleaser. I like to sort of like be validated and have like, you know, approval and everyone like me and stuff like that. And actually, that's not so important with the world of books. You know, there are millions of books out there. If you want to make your mark in the world of books, you don't have to write the book that everybody's going to like or, you know, have universal acclaim. You have to write a book that just connects with some people and can, you know, hopefully connects it with them in a big way. And then your readership can sort of expand from there. And to sort of like do your own thing, express yourself in your own way and be honest to yourself. So yeah, that's my corny bit of writerly advice.
Well, I don't think it's corny. I think it's a brilliant way to end the show. We appreciate your time and wisdom and please come back and visit us again.
Thank you, Kelton. That was a pleasure and a joy. Thank you.
A conversation about Rain. 19 years before she decided to die, Nora Seed sat in the warmth of the small library at Hazeldean School in the town of Bedford. She sat at a low table staring at a chessboard. "Nora, dear, it's natural to worry about your future," said the librarian, Mrs. Elm, her eyes twinkling. Mrs. Elm made her first move, a knight hopping over the neat row of white pawns. "Of course you're going to be worried about the exams. But you could be anything you want to be, Nora. Think of all that possibility. It's exciting." "Yes, I suppose it is. A whole life in front of you. A whole life. You could do anything. Live anywhere. Somewhere a bit less cold and wet." Nora pushed a pawn forward 2 spaces. It was hard not to compare Mrs. Elm to her mother, who treated Nora like a mistake in need of correction. For instance, when she was a baby, her mother had been so worried Nora's left ear stuck out more than her right that she'd used sticky tape to address the situation, then disguised it beneath a woolen bonnet. "I hate the cold and wet," added Mrs. Elm for emphasis. Mrs. Elm had short grey hair and a kind and mildly crinkled oval face, sitting pale above her turtle green polo neck. She was quite old, but she was also the person most on Nora's wavelength in the entire school. And even on days when it wasn't raining, she would spend her afternoon break in the small library. "Coldness and wetness don't always go together," Nora told her. "Antarctica is the driest continent on Earth. Technically, it's a desert." "Well, that sounds up your street." "I don't think it's far enough away." "Well, maybe you should be an astronaut. Travel the galaxy." Nora smiled. "The rain is even worse on other planets." "Worse than Bedfordshire? On Venus, it is pure acid." Mrs. Elm pulled a paper tissue from her sleeve and delicately blew her nose. "See? With a brain like yours, you can do anything." A blonde boy Nora recognized from a couple of years below her ran past outside the rain-speckled window, either chasing someone or being chased. Since her brother had left, she'd felt a bit unguarded out there. The library was a little shelter of civilization. "Dad thinks I've thrown everything away. Now I've stopped swimming." "Well, far be it from me to say, but there is more to this world than swimming really fast. There are many different possible lives ahead of you. Like I said last week, you could be a glaciologist. I've been researching and the..." And it was then that the phone rang. "1 minute," said Mrs. Elm softly. "I'd better get that." A moment later, Nora watched Mrs. Elm on the phone. "Yes, she's here now." The librarian's face fell in shock. She turned away from Nora, but her words were audible across the hushed room. "Oh, no. No. Oh, my God. Of course."
Thanks so much for joining us for this episode of The Writer Files. And if you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe to the show and leave us a rating or a review to help other writers out there find us. You can always leave a comment or a question and visit the entire archives at writerfiles.fm. And you can chat with me on Twitter at Kelton Reed. Cheers. Talk to you next week.